Hello, it's Tuesday, August the 24th, and this is the Andrew Pearce Show, coming, as ever, from the Daily Mail newsroom. Did you know it is actually possible to die of a broken heart? Also, McDonald's, they're running out of milkshakes. There's a big problem in the supply chain because we don't have enough HGV drivers. The Health Secretary, Sajid Javid, is going to crack down on cowboys who are exploiting people in the COVID testing market. And not before time. Extinction Rebellion, they port part of central London grinding to a halt, but of course they say it's not them, they blame the police. I wonder who you blame. But first, the evacuation of 6,000 UK nationals and Afghans from Afghanistan is reaching its climax. But sadly, many brave Afghans who fought alongside British troops face being left behind. The evacuation of 6,000 UK nationals and eligible Afghans from Kabul is reaching its final hours. More than 1,000 brave Afghans who fought alongside British troops, however, face being left behind. Among them, around 100 interpreters who served with British forces. Some have spoken of the Taliban going door to door to locate the interpreters who worked with British forces. Joining me now is Dave Williams, who's led the campaign at the Daily Mail for the best part of 5 or 6 years to get the interpreters and the Afghan staff out. And he joins me now. Dave, this, you've been writing about this for years. It seems pretty shameful that here we are now, probably just hours from the deadline for withdrawal expiring, and some of those translators and their families will not be rescued.
Andrew, I think shameful is the exact right word. I'm hearing today from translators still trapped in their homes, fearing to go out, telling me about door-to-door knocks by the Taliban. Others have been stopped at Taliban checkpoints as they try to make it through to the airport. One 48-year-old who worked for 7 years on the front lines for the British told me that he had had a gun pushed in his chest at the checkpoint and warned never to return, i.e. never to go back to the airport. That's the kind of stories that we're consistently hearing. However, I would say that quite a significant number are getting through daily, and the strain is easing, but we should never have been in this position. Certainly, we still have translators who were approved 8 months ago who remain in country and have not yet been moved.
What's been the problem, Dave, with this? Because, as I say, you've been writing about this for years. The Mail has been campaigning on this issue. We've heard Ben Wallace, the Defence Secretary, talking very eloquently and movingly about the plight of these interpreters. But why didn't they pull their finger out months ago and get them out? Because they always knew that if Biden followed Trump's lead in withdrawing American troops, they would be under huge pressure from the Taliban.
I think Ben Wallace in particular, and Priti Patel to a degree, have made a huge difference. Ben Wallace, a former soldier, and he's recognised the need to move. His changes of policy have certainly saved a lot of lives. The problem is that it has been very, very slow. One of the difficulties has been accommodation in this country. Many Afghan families are large, and it's been a problem finding councils who are prepared to have 5, 6, 7 families of maybe 6 to 10 members and have the accommodation to release that. On the other hand, that certainly people should have been brought here. I was hearing from a lot of translators who were telling us that they would be very happy to go into a military camp. Their priority was to escape the Taliban and the threats. You've got to remember against the background here that since 2014, more than 350 translators have been murdered. They're not just British translators, they were translators who worked for the coalition. This year alone, we've had 7 translators that we know of killed. And also the revenge against translators' families has been considerable. And that's one of the things that we're hearing now, is that the Taliban are going to people's houses looking for named translators. And then when they can't find it, they're taking the revenge on families. Not in recent days, but certainly last month, I heard of 5 instances where relatives have been killed, 3 fathers and 2 brothers.
Just finally, Dave, what are the prospects for these interpreters who we do not get out? Can they disappear in Afghanistan and evade the clutches of the Taliban, or do you fear they will be caught and probably killed?
I very much fear that if they're not got out during this evacuation, and there are only days remaining, then they will have to go to ground. Some of them are extremely able to hide. Others won't be able to hide. And yes, they're going to have to try and melt away and go across the border. Pakistan, Iran are the favoured routes. I know of two translators and their families who have already heading with people smugglers over here. But if they hide, most of them fear that they will be found, and the Taliban's got time on its side. The translators haven't.
Well, that's very very chilling. That's Dave Williams, who's been running this extraordinary campaign at the Mail to try to get these interpreters out. I think there's no doubt that the campaign by Dave Williams and the Mail has undoubtedly saved the lives of some interpreters, but I fear it probably won't save enough. The climate change activism campaign Extinction Rebellion have started another two-week protest. They brought much of central London grinding to a halt yesterday, resulting in traffic jams, angry shop owners and up to 50 arrests. What are they hoping to achieve this time? I'm joined now by a former spokesman for the Extinction Rebellion campaign group, Rupert Reid. Rupert, isn't this government doing more than most in Europe and the rest of the world to batten down the hatches on carbon emission?
Short answer, no. They're opening a new coal mine. They're looking into new oil fields. They're building HS2, massive new roads program. They want a third runway at Heathrow. Frankly, they're a global disgrace. And in terms of shutting down most of London, it was actually the police who shut down quite a lot of London yesterday. The Extinction Rebellion were quite smart yesterday. They didn't block roads, but the police did block roads. They barricaded them off. I was there. I saw it. And, well, I suspect that they're basically dancing to the tune of the government on this one, and it's much to be regretted.
But isn't the fact that protests like this take place in central London going to have, it's going to be have a detrimental effect on retailers who've had a torrid 18 months because of the pandemic? It's going to make it difficult for people to come into central London to spend money, and the same will apply if you do this in other major towns and cities.
Well, it's interesting you mention other major towns or cities. So let's compare with what happened in the G7 protest that I was at in Cornwall last month. The police there took a totally different approach. They facilitated the protest, which moved smoothly through the streets as a result, and local businesses were not handicapped at all. As I say, the problem, I was there last night and I saw it, and there were businesses speaking to Channel 4 about it. It was the police who barricaded the streets off because they wanted to stop people from getting through to Extinction Rebellion and talking to them. It's political policing. It's what the Met does, and it's really much to be regretted. It's not the approach taken by other police forces. I predict confidently it will not be the approach taken by the Scottish police when we have the climate COP in the autumn. And I really think here the Met need to be learning from these other police forces how to police in a much more cooperative fashion.
But, I mean, you'll blame the police. The police will blame Extinction Rebellion. I go back to my point again, Rupert, a two-week protest. Haven't you got better things to do with your time?
Well, 2 weeks, the point about 2 weeks is that people's attention needs to be focused on this. So take the IPCC report that came out recently. Terrifying report, climate code red, gripped the world's headlines for 24 hours. And then we went back to business as usual with news being dominated by COVID and celebrities having affairs and whatever. The point about 2 weeks is people's attention needs to be focused on this to understand that this is a crisis, this is an emergency, this is a condition that will define the rest of all of our lives. We can't just pay attention to it for a short period of time and then turn away again. We have to transform our systems. We have to at least make a serious start by doing as XR are calling for this time and saying, let's have no new fossil fuels in this country. And that's such a minimal, moderate demand, frankly. Why would we need more fossil fuels when we've already got more than enough to fry the world twice over?
But people know that Britain is a very small net contributor in terms of carbon emissions. The real problems are in countries like China, India, in the United States. isn't that where the protest should be, if you're going to protest at all? Because I don't think you're going to get any more traction out of this government, because they will argue, with some justification in my view, that they're a pretty green government.
Well, you know, when right-wing commentators say, well, Britain really doesn't matter very much in relation to this, I think, why are you doing this country down? Britain could be a global leader in a new green industrial revolution. We could lead the world. We could show the way to other countries which are looking to make the kind of green transition that is needed. But they need to see countries like ourselves leading. So I put the question back to you, Andrew. Why are you doing this country down?
Well, I'm not doing it down at all. But don't you think a lot of families who will be listening to this podcast, reading about Extinction Rebellion, will say it's all very well. They want us to become much more environmentally friendly, but it's hugely expensive. The cost of replacing our gas boilers currently, if you had your way, we'd have them all ripped out, presumably in the next year or two, will be around £10,000. That's way beyond the reach of most families.
Well, Andrew, you're right there. There is a serious cost to this, and that has to be faced directly. That begs the question, who should pay this cost? And what I say is, it shouldn't be ordinary working people who pay it. It should be the rich, and in particular, it should be the companies that have been profiting from all this rubbish in the first place. So the fossil fuel companies should have a windfall tax against them, for example. That would give us a lot of money with which to make the green transition.
But taxes are normally, as you well know, Rupert, passed on to ordinary people. Companies get the money back somehow, don't they?
No, that's the point. I'm saying the profits of these companies should be extracted, because if you want to talk about costs, you know, the real cost is going to be to all of our futures. If we don't make this green transition and make it rapidly, the kind of costs that are involved in the tiny amount of disruption that XR are causing, the kind of substantial costs, you're right, that are involved in making the green transition, these are going to be dwarfed into insignificance by the cost of the destruction of our infrastructure. In the Daily Mail, for instance, you're very interested in house prices. I can tell you that house prices are going to go through the floor if we have the kind of climate-induced economic catastrophe which is likely to come over the next generation. As climate hits our way of life, our country, so much harder than it has done so far. What happened this year in Germany, those massive floods, what happened in North America, we've seen glimpses of it in this country with the flash flooding in London, but we ain't seen nothing yet. It's coming for us. It's coming hard for us. If we want to avoid paying that cost, we have to act now.
All fine words, Rupert, but isn't there an awful lot of rank hypocrisy in your ranks? You will have heard the row on the radio this morning when Gail Bradbrook, one of the founders of Extinction Rebellion, admitted she drives a diesel car. Why is she driving a diesel car?
Well, you'll have to ask Gail that, but really...
Are you embarrassed by the fact? Are you embarrassed by the fact? I mean, do you? What sort of car do you drive?
Is that honestly the best we can do?
Rupert, she's a founder. Rupert, she's a founder of Extinction Rebellion, who wags her finger at us, telling us all how bad we are at wrecking the environment. She drives a diesel car. No, I'm not wrong. You're wrong. I'm asking you, are you not embarrassed about her? It's double standards and hypocrisy.
Let me make my point, Andrew. She doesn't wag her finger.
Well, I disagree with you.
What Extinction Rebellion have said very clearly from the start is no naming, no shaming, no blaming. We are all in this together. If it's anyone wagging their finger, it's your own guilty conscience.
Okay, so do you think she should be driving? Do you think she should be driving a diesel car, bearing in mind her exalted position in Extinction Rebellion?
What I think is that we should stop all the finger wagging.
Right, so you won't condemn her. So it's okay for her to be hypocritical.
I won't condemn her, because condemnation doesn't get us anywhere, Andrew.
What about the hypocrisy? What about the hypocrisy, Rupert? What about the hypocrisy?
We have to face our own involvement, all of us involved in a system which is dreadfully imperfect.
Yeah.
We need to change that system together. Let's stop pointing the finger.
Right.
Let's have a calmer conversation about how together we're going to change to a society which enables everybody to make the right choice.
She's a hypocrite, Rupert, isn't she? Rupert, she's a hypocrite.
That's all you can do, isn't it? That's all that you can do.
Why don't you accept she's hypocritical? Why don't you accept she's hypocritical,
Rupert? What I'm trying to point out to you is that she's not finger-pointing.
Right.
You're finger-pointing.
What sort of car do you drive, Rupert? What sort of car do you drive, Rupert?
At the moment, I don't have a car. I'm looking into getting an electric car, but that's not the point. The point is we have to change our systems. We have to all do it together. Otherwise, we are going to be stuffed by
pity,
what's coming.
It's a pity your chief disciples aren't doing it all together.
Well, it's a pity that that's all that you can see fit to talk about.
Let me guarantee to you, Rupert, a lot of people will be talking about it because she's one of the founders of Extinction Rebellion who does not practice what she preaches. Thank you for joining us.
A lot of people will talk about it if they do, because you are insisting that they do.
But you're just embarrassed, Rupert, that it's come out.
No, not at all.
Yeah, I think you are.
You.
Don't be embarrassed for me, Rupert. Don't be embarrassed for me, my dear. I'm beyond being embarrassed by Extinction Rebellion. But thank you for coming on, and thank you as ever for making a lively defence for your cause. That's Rupert Reed, who is a former spokesman for Extinction Rebellion. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces, and much, much more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at mailplus. Or me at Tory Boy Pierce. The Health Secretary, Sajid Javid, said he's going to crack down on cowboys in the travel testing COVID market. The government has identified numerous companies, they say, who are displaying misleading prices for COVID tests on the government's own website, only for travellers to find the final bill is much higher when they get to pay. Aviation analyst Alex Macheras joins me now. Alex, we've heard a lot of talk from the government about getting the prices of these tests down, and nothing seems to happen. Is this now the first time do you see something positive happening here?
It's a very, very small step in the right direction, but I would really stress this is a small step. And that is because the government's entire rhetoric right now is as if they are frustrated and upset with these so-called, quote, cowboys ripping off passengers. But what I think listeners should remember is that the UK government created this market. They hired the cowboys. There were cowboys when they presented themselves to the government, and the government approved them and put them on their website because nothing has changed. They didn't evolve into becoming dishonest. They were dishonest from the beginning. So I think the onus is on them. This is the government that has created the world's most expensive, dishonest, and quite frankly, corrupt mandatory passenger testing market, riddled with all of these companies that's only intention is to rip off consumers and profit from a pandemic.
How much do you think it would be a reasonable price for these tests? And what are currently some of these dodgy companies charging, Alex?
Well, see, first and foremost, if this was a market with regulation, then we would be seeing PCRs cost similar across the board, not just across the UK, but across the channel in France, for example, and across with Spain and all of these neighbouring countries, because ultimately it is the same test and the overwhelming majority take around 24 hours to process that result. So, in European countries, you can get PCRs for around 50 euros. Obviously, that translates into less when you convert it into pounds. That's not the case here. And because some of these firms are able to advertise a single PCR to cost in excess of £100, that's the most common. You can have PCR tests promised within the next day, £119 per person, and they're advertising that as if it's a great deal. Well, the truth is that it's a great deal on the market that is riddled with extortionate pricing. But if you glance out for a minute and kind of look at where we are with other nations, it's not a great deal at all. They are profiting. And we know this because for months and months, before international travel even had taken off, like it has a little bit for August, passengers have been spending £12 million per week on these mandatory tests. We can't say the same for other nations. That is only happening here.
And it is astonishing that quite how many government-approved companies there are. There are more than 400. Do you think that's part of the problem? And that's why it's been almost impossible to regulate?
Absolutely. And it's as with everything with the travel policy in this pandemic with the government, it's all shrouded in mystery. So, why are the government not coming forward and saying here is the criteria as to how we enlisted these 400 plus companies to be government approved? Instead, they have approved what looks like all of them. And then a few months later, now that government ministers themselves have looked to travel given the recess, have they realized, goodness me, it's so expensive, it's extortionate, I'm going to draft out a tweet accusing them of cowboys. As I said, they were cowboys when they were hired.
Yeah. Just finally, Alex, the government, Sajid Javid has highlighted 82 private travel testing firms who he says are conducting misleading prices, and they're getting a two-strike warning they could be struck off, and a further 57 will be removed if they don't do something too. That's nearly 150. That is a staggering number of so-called cowboy companies who, as you say, were there right from the word go.
Absolutely. And don't forget, it's not simply that passengers can choose to avoid those so-called cardboard companies and move over to others. Actually, often passengers are cornered into those companies because the rest say they are sold out. They do not have the laboratory space to process, and so they can't offer you a test. And so people that are desperate to be able to obtain a passenger locator form, which of course is a condition to enter this country, even for British nationals, then, you know, you're in this situation where you're having families forced to fork out on companies that should never have been enlisted in the first place. So what I think we need for a sustainable approach going forward is actual market regulation, just like we have in so many other areas of society. It's crazy that we're reaching September and nothing has been done here.
Indeed. That's the aviation analyst, Alex Macheras. Thanks for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with our other podcasts and video series. And don't forget to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. Well, it's now time for our regular city update with Ruth Sunderland, who is, of course, business editor at the Daily Mail. Ruth, McDonald's, one of the many companies now being affected by a shortage in the supply chain.
Yes, they are, Andrew. I don't know about you. I'm not an habituée of McDonald's, but lots and lots of people are. And they will have noticed that in some McDonald's, you haven't been able to get your normal milkshake. Now, this to a lot of people will be disappointing, particularly families. And it's to do with supply chain issues that we have seen building up over the past week. So, I mean, more interest to some of our listeners might be the fact that Adnams, the pub chain, said it's been struggling to find wine. And we've seen a couple of businesses, the Nando's had to close some of its restaurants because they had a shortage of chicken. And there's been a couple of firms making cleaning products. For instance, there's an outfit called McBride's, which makes cleaning solutions for Tesco and Sainsbury's, said that its profits have been kind of wiped out because it just can't get its goods to the shelves. And this is all really a product of the pandemic, really, and also a lack of HGV lorry drivers. So we just can't get the goods out there on the shelves that when they're needed or wanted.
And the HGV driver shortage has been blamed in some quarters by Brexit. But I notice even in the Financial Times, which, of course, was a great champion of us staying in the European Union, they say Brexit is not the reason why there is this shortage.
That's absolutely right. So Brexit has contributed a little bit, as the FT noted, and you know, you can't deny that there were some HGV drivers who have now gone back home as a result of Brexit and the pandemic, and who are not around. But it isn't the main reason. So all of those Ramoners who are saying, "Oh, I told you so," well, you know, really they're wrong, because the shortage in HGV lorry drivers has been building up for quite a while, and it's more to do with the fact that the wages in comparison with other jobs that you can do are just not really that attractive, and the hours are obviously difficult and long and antisocial. So the upshot to all of this is that the Road Haulage Association is saying there's a shortage of more than 100,000 drivers in the UK. That's out of, there were around 600,000. So that's a big chunk, a big shortage. And the majority of those people are getting on a little bit. So they're 45 or older. And when they retire, there aren't the new people coming in. So I think the only solution to this, really, Andrew, is how do you get people to do things? Well, usually you have to increase their wages if you want to attract people into a particular job. So I think that's probably what's going to have to happen here.
Very interesting, Ruth, as ever. That's Ruth Sunderland, who is, of course, business editor at the Daily Mail. So it is actually possible to die from a broken heart, and there's even a medical term for it, which is Takotsubo cardiomyopathy. The condition often occurs after bereavement, and it affects around 2,500 Britons a year, and sometimes it's fatal. Here to discuss this is Dr. David Gamble, who is a cardiology clinical research fellow at the British Heart Foundation. Dr. Gamble, how do we know it is potentially because of a broken heart? Why can't the heart condition just be caused by something different?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, often these patients present very typically like they're having a heart attack. So they present with chest pain, breathlessness, some of the early investigations that you would do in the emergency department are very suggestive of a heart attack. But actually, as they go a bit further down their kind of clinical journey, they have the various other tests you do, an angiogram, which is what looks at the blood vessels in the heart, and some of the movements of the heart when you look with the ultrasound echocardiography probe suddenly starts to suggest this isn't a heart attack, and actually it's this condition, Takotsubo cardiomyopathy.
And why is it, in your view, doctor, that 90% of patients who suffer from this condition are women, and women aged over 50?
Yeah, that, I mean, you've really hit the nail on the head with that question there, Andrew. So we don't necessarily know, but it is overwhelmingly affects, you know, kind of postmenopausal women. And, you know, there are some suggestions that actually perhaps some of the hormonal differences when you're postmenopausal may play a role. You know, we know that women have different levels of things that affect their mental health, whether that's stress, anxiety, or depression. There may well be an autoimmune possibly component to things, which does that as a class of conditions often affects women more. We don't honestly know, and we certainly don't have a fixed, you know, this definitely for this reason. And it's part of the, you know, it's part of the reason this condition is in need of, you know, much more research, funding, etc., to answer some of these questions.
And I think it's right, isn't it, that this condition is not caused by blocked arteries, as most or a lot of heart attacks are.
Yeah, so a heart attack by definition is a blocked artery supplying a bit of the muscle in the heart. This is not the case for a Takotsubo cardiomyopathy. You know, there's no blockages in the coronary artery, so those are the arteries that supply the heart. There's no blockages there that's causing the problem. It's totally different to a heart attack.
And I was going to ask you too, is this right that it's not always stress or bereavement that could be the trigger? Happy occasions can also spark the condition. A study in University Hospital Zurich said that there, in some patients, it was an emotional trigger which triggered the condition, such as a birthday party, even a surprise marriage proposal.
I've not read that. I've not read that particular study myself. I mean, it's any sudden emotional event can trigger it. Now, those typically are ones, you know, that might be a bereavement. It might be a road traffic accident. But anything that you know, causes the sort of fight or flight response in a person, and that could be a bunch of your friends jumping out saying happy birthday when you weren't expecting it. I suppose anything that initiates that kind of those pathways that exist between your brain and the rest of your body, you know, could do it. But it's often the I suppose more negative emotional ones that we see if it's an emotional trigger.
Very interesting. Is there any advice to people worrying about this to perhaps insulate yourself against this happening? I suppose there isn't really. If the emotional trigger happens, it happens.
Yeah, I mean, again, you've asked a very interesting question, and because we need to understand much more about this condition, you know, there is probably something in someone's heart that predisposes them, because not everyone that has a bereavement has a Takotsubo cardiomyopathy. Not everyone that has a surprise birthday party has a Takotsubo cardiomyopathy. So we don't know what that is, but, you know, it would make sense that there is a predisposed heart somehow there to begin with. What we need to do is kind of, you know, work out the details of that. And in terms of things that people can, you know, insulate themselves from, we just don't know. You know, it's a really interesting condition from a research point of view, because there are lots of unanswered questions that we need to tackle in order to, you know, develop the abilities to kind of risk stratify people, be able to identify people perhaps that are more likely to you know, suffer from this condition. But, you know, it at the moment we don't have those things, and there isn't a great deal that we can suggest, you know, with our hands on some solid evidence to help reduce the risk of these things happening.
Very interesting. Very interesting indeed. That's Dr. David Gamble, who is a cardiology clinical research fellow at the British Heart Foundation. Thanks for joining us. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I am Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.